Yet a little later, he says, Pausanias and the Spartiates yielded the command to them and urged them to take up position against the Persians, receiving the right wing themselves and handing over the left wing to the Athenians, on the ground that from inexperience, they were declining battle with the barbarians. And yet it is absurd, if they were used to the enemy, to suppose they should be unwilling to fight. But as for the rest of the Greeks, led off to the other general's camp, he says, when the cavalry moved, they gladly fled toward the city of the Plataeans, and in their flight they arrived at the Harium. In which passage he accuses them, virtually all of them together, of insubordination, desertion, and treachery. In the end, he says that only the Lacedaemonians and Tegeans fought it out against the barbarians, and only the Athenians against the Thebans, while he strips all the other cities alike of any share in the success. No one else took part in the struggle, but all sat still, laid down their arms, and betrayed those who were fighting on their behalf. And it was only late that the Phlyasians and Megareans, on learning that Pausanias was winning, advanced and fell in with the Theban cavalry, and were destroyed for no good reason. While the Corinthians were not present at the battle at all, but after the victory, hurrying through the hills, chanced not to encounter the Theban horsemen. For the Thebans, once the rout had occurred, rode ahead of the barbarians and eagerly came to the aid of them as they fled, clearly repaying the marks branded on them at Thermopylae. But as for the Corinthians, one may learn from Simonides both the position in which they fought against the barbarians and how great an outcome they won from the struggle at Plataea, where he writes as follows. And in the middle were those who dwell in Ephra of many springs, skilled in every excellence in war, and those who occupy the city of Glaucus, the town of Corinth, who set as the fairest witness of their toils gold in the sky honored, and it increases the wide renown both of themselves and of their fathers. For these lines Simonides recorded not while training a chorus at Corinth, nor composing a song for the city, but simply as history of those deeds, writing them in elegiac verse. Herodotus, anticipating the refutation of his falsehood by those who would ask, whence, then, the mass graves and so many tombs and memorials of the dead, at which the Plataeans down to this day offer sacrifice in the presence of the assembled Greeks, has, I think, made an accusation more shameful than the very charge of treachery he brings against these families, in the following words. As for the rest, whatever tombs are also to be seen at Plataea, these, as I learn, were heaped up by each of the cities as empty mounds, out of shame at their absence from the battle, for the sake of those who should come after. This absence from the battle, which amounts to treachery, Herodotus alone of all men has ever heard of. It escaped the notice of Pausanias and Aristides, and the Lacedaemonians and Athenians that the Greeks had abandoned them in the danger. And neither did the Athenians, though at odds with the Aeginetans, bar them from the inscription, nor did they expose the Corinthians, whom they had earlier defeated and put to flight from Salamis, though all Greece bore witness against them. And yet it was Cletus the Plataean who, 10 years after the Persian Wars, currying favor with the Aeginetans, as Herodotus himself says, inscribed the mass grave with their name. What then made the Athenians and Lacedaemonians, who at that very time nearly came to blows with one another over the trophy of the victory, refrain from driving out those Greeks who had shown cowardice and run away from the prizes of valor? Instead, they inscribed them on the trophies and on the colossal monuments and gave them a share of the spoils, and in the end, they engraved on the altar this inscription. When the Greeks, by the might of victory, by the work of Ares, trusting in bold courage of soul, had driven out the Persians, they set up in common, for a free Greece, an altar of Zeus the Liberator. Was this too, Herodotus, inscribed by Cletus or someone else flattering the cities? Why, then, did they need to dig up the earth for nothing, to trouble themselves and idly heap up mounds and build memorials for the sake of those to come, when they could see their glory consecrated among the most conspicuous and greatest dedications? And indeed Pausanias, as they say, already harboring tyrannical ambitions, had inscribed at Delphi. When as leader of the Greeks he destroyed the army of the Medes, Pausanias dedicated this memorial to Phoebus, thereby, in a way, making the Greeks share the glory of what he had proclaimed himself sole commander of. But when the Greeks would not tolerate this, and brought charges, the Lacedaemonians sent men to Delphi and had this inscription chiseled out, and in its place engraved the names of the cities, as was just. And yet, how is it likely either that the Greeks who had no share in the inscription would be indignant, if they were themselves conscious of having deserted the battle, or that the Lacedaemonians, after erasing the name of their own leader and general, would inscribe those who had abandoned them and looked on at the danger? How utterly monstrous it would be if Sophanes and Eumnestus, and all those who fought with distinction in that battle, were not vexed even when the Scythians and the Melians were inscribed on the trophies. Yet Herodotus was. He, having assigned the struggle to three cities alone, chisels all the rest out from the trophies and the sacred dedications. Of the four engagements that then took place against the barbarians, he says the Greeks fled from Artemisium. And at Thermopylae, while their general and the king himself risk their lives in the vanguard, he has them sitting idle and neglecting the fight to celebrate the Olympic and Carnian festivals. And in his account of Salamis, he has written so much about Artemisia that he has not reported the whole sea battle in as many words. Finally, sitting at Plataea, he has the Greeks ignorant to the very end of how the battle went, as though it were some battle of the frogs and mice. The sort of thing Pigors, Artemisia's kinsman, wrote for sport and nonsense in verse, agreeing to fight it out in silence so as to escape the notice of the rest. And he has the Lacedaemonians themselves prove no better in courage than the barbarians, but win only because they fought armed and armored against men naked and unarmed. For while Xerxes himself was present, the barbarians were driven forward against the Greeks scarcely by whips at their backs. But at Plataea, it seems, they took on other souls. In spirit and strength they were not inferior, but their clothing, being bare of armor, did them the greatest harm, for being light-armed they fought a battle against hoplites. What then remains glorious or great for the Greeks from those struggles, if the Lacedaemonians fought against unarmed men, and the rest were absent from the battle without anyone's notice, and the mass graves honored for each are empty, and the tripods and altars beside the gods stand full of false inscriptions, while Herodotus alone has known the truth, and all the rest of mankind, as many as have any repute among the Greeks, have been deceived by the report of those exploits of that time. As though they had been something extraordinary? What then? The man is a vivid writer, his style is pleasing, and his narratives have charm and cleverness and a certain bloom. And like a bard telling a tale, though not with full understanding, he has spoken clearly and gracefully. To be sure, these qualities charm and win everyone over. But, as one must beware of the blister beetle hidden among roses, so one must beware of his slander and malicious speech, concealed beneath a smooth and gentle style, lest unawares we come away holding absurd and false opinions about the best and greatest of the cities and men of Greece.